When you love riding a motorcycle, you want to ride it everywhere, even to a physical.
Let's check your weight. Hop on the scale. Look at that. You're down a few pounds.
Oh, yeah. Must be the new carbon fiber wheels.
And when you love saving money, you want to save even more. That's why GEICO makes it easy to bundle your motorcycle and car insurance.
I'm going to prescribe 91 octane for your engine knock, and we'll want to see you again in 3,000 miles.
Kickstart your savings with GEICO Motorcycle. Bundle and save on the things you love.
From the basement of the Bob and Tom Studios, it's That Josh Arnold Podcast.
Boy, I hit that every time, don't I? I've gotten pretty good at that. You know, maybe I've been good at that from the start. Hitting those posts, is that what it's called, Jason? Yes, yeah. All right. It is That Josh Arnold Podcast. My goodness, look at you, huh? Looking good. Hope you're feeling well. Heck of a show this week. The first week of December. It's December 1st. Winter, I don't think it's technically here, but it's here. My guest this week, oh my gosh, I love this person very much. It's you! We're going to talk with you and, well, see how your Thanksgiving went. I hope it went terrifically. Mine did. It was very nice. I'm here currently in the basement, and I just saw a spider. Isn't it weird when you see a spider when it's cold out? You're like, what are you doing? Like the last hanger on or whatever? It's like, all right. He was moving kind of slow, so it's either, you know, close to the end for it, or it, yeah, I don't know what, I kind of don't know. I think spiders maybe go underground or something for the winter. I don't know. Or if they all just die and then new spiders come up in the spring. That's something that I should probably know. And I probably did learn at one point, but I'm pretty convinced that they don't all die off and then new spiders. It's all new spiders in the spring. I don't think that's the case. Anywho, good Thanksgiving. I cooked a lot. I made my first turkey, and it ended up, it turned out very good. Perhaps a little overcooked, and the reason I say that is I think I cooked it the, well, I was told 13 minutes per pound, and I had a 15-pound bird, and so I did the math, of course, on my calculator. There's no way I could do it in my head, and I cooked it for that amount of time. And when I checked the temperature at the end of that amount of time, they say you want your bird to be about 165. I was at like 200. So that seemed much hotter than I needed to be, but it wasn't dry, it wasn't dried out, and it sure tasted good. And boy, it had a nice golden crispy skin. I was really happy with it. So I hope your turkey, if you had one, turned out good as well. And I've got to be honest, it's been leftovers palooza at my place. I cooked a turkey and I made stuffing and mashed potatoes and sweet potatoes. And then I cheat. And those were all, you know, from scratch, as it were. And then I cheated a little bit with I made frozen peas. But I love frozen peas. And then the gravy, I got jarred gravy. But hey, you know, maybe next year I'll try making my own gravy. But it worked out very well this year. And yes, a very nice Thanksgiving. And I've literally had Thanksgiving leftovers. Oh boy, what are we on? Day six now? And I think my body's slowly shutting down. But I'll eat something different today. Well, you know what? I've got my last leftovers, I think, today. I could finish it all off. Well, not the turkey. There's too much of that. So, but the sides I can finish off today and then move on with my life. This week's sponsor. Oh boy, I'd really like to thank this sponsor because it's a special one to me, and I hope it is to you too. This week's sponsor: a hot bowl of soup. Oh boy, especially now that the weather is getting chilly and. And by the way, I'm not including chili in this sponsorship. It's just soup. Why, do you ask? Well, because I'll probably need a sponsor in future podcasts, and chili will be it. And this doesn't include stew either. Just soup. Oh, whether it be chicken noodle or tomato or French onion. And you know what? I'm going to exclude chowders in this also. This is just a hot bowl of soup. You warm it up and you sit at your table and maybe you watch some snow falling and you like to slurp your soup? You make noise? Go for it. You want crackers? Oh my gosh, you can crumble, you can dip, you can do whatever. Maybe just a simple snap in half. That's, well, you know what I do? I mean, this is fat, but I crumble crackers into the soup, and then I take other crackers and dip them into the soup and sort of scoop up the crumbled crackers. It's, oh boy, anyway, thank you, hot bowl of soup. And why don't you enjoy a hot bowl of soup sometime soon? This week's word is perhaps more of a phrase, but I think it's very fitting for this time of year. It has to do with decorating for Christmas. And, well, I see the train is here. We might as well hop on board and head on off to Vocabulary Station. Ah! Maybe we enjoy a bowl of soup on our way to Vocabulary Station, huh? Actually, that's got to be eating soup in any moving vehicles, I guess a bit of a risky venture, but hey, here we are at Vocabulary Station, and this week's word/phrase, it's a French term, finial darba. Now, or dabra, I apologize. I don't speak French. This is, just bear with me. Finial dabra is a noun, and it means an ornament that sits atop a Christmas tree. So, now, technically, a star doesn't really count as a finial dabra, but what I'm going to tell you is this. I think you can use it for anything that's going to sit atop your Christmas tree. Why? Because I think it's funny for you to go, honey, where's the finial dabra? And then dabra. And then when they go, what the hell are you talking about? You go, the star, the whatever we're putting on top of the tree, the angel, the maybe it's an actual finial dabra, which is, you've seen them. They look sort of pointy, and they've a lot of times they have sort of ornate leaf type structure, and you've certainly seen them on maybe fancier Christmas trees, fancier than mine. I've just got a star that lights up. But yes, use that word this week. Well, we're not done decorating until we put on the finial dabra. Did I say it again? I said it wrong again. Finial dabra. Here, you know why this is throwing me off? Because the French spelled it with two R's. So it's D apostrophe A-R-B-R-E, which just means tree or of the tree, essentially. So, well, we all Arbor Day. This all makes sense. But they don't pronounce that R that we would. They just pronounce the second one. So dabra. Ugh. The French... what's the old Steve Martin joke? It's like they have a different word for everything. Finial. And a finial is a knob or some sort of any kind of decorative structure that caps or ends something. So maybe at the top of a banister or a bedpost or the top of a lamp. You have finials all over the place. Finial dabra, the tree topper. How about that? Use it and let me know how that goes. And, yeah, let me know if you're called a pretentious a-hole when you do use it. Oh boy, it's been a pretty nice week. Well, why don't I get right to telling you about what I enjoyed this week? Well, look at that. There's a Christmas tree sporting a finial dabra, walking down the street right there. This is my new thing. Whatever it is, I did it for, Halloween? I think I did it last week for the turkey. Any holiday, it's just going to be the main symbol of that holiday, walking down the street. So, you know, a Christmas tree, you know, I could have a big, thick tree walking down the street. That's funny. In case you didn't realize it was meant to be funny, I'll just tell you, that's funny. With the nice, shiny finial dabra on top and, oh, yeah, looking, well, he's walking quite, proud, isn't he? He knows he's the symbol of the next few weeks. How about that? What was this segment again? Ah, yes. What I enjoyed this week. This week it's a little different. I often talk about movies I like or music or books. Well, this week, and it did kind of strike me as a surprise where I went, oh, you know what? I really enjoy this, and I think this could be what I enjoyed this week. I saw a lot of movies over the holiday weekend and really enjoyed them. What did I watched Go West with the Marx Brothers, a Marx Brothers movie I hadn't seen and had quite frankly heard that it wasn't that strong, but I have to tell you, I laughed the whole time. I loved it. And I watched, a handful of good movies, and I listened to good music and I read, but the thing that I really enjoyed this week was a photograph. And it reminds me that photographs, they're so common, and we're taking pictures all the time with our phones and we're posting them on social media, but you really do kind of, it's easy to take for granted the power of a picture. Photographs can tell, I mean, just one snapshot can tell quite a story. And, you know, it's when you look at pictures, you should really take a little more time with it. Really study it. You know, why was it framed in that way? And what is it trying to evoke? And, you know, like any good art, and photography certainly is art, it's just, it can be really fascinating. And again, we look at so many pictures all day, every day, and we take so many that it's easy to forget that it's quite a powerful medium. So anyway, the photograph that I just couldn't stop looking at the other day, and I'm going to I'll post it on my Instagram today as well, in case you haven't seen it, or so that you can see it. It's a picture of two celebrities, kind of at the height of their stardom, and two unlikely celebrities, unlikely in that you may not assume that they ever would have spent time together. It's Dolly Parton and John Belushi, and they are sitting at a table, kind of a fancy table, with some you know, nice looking silverware and glassware. And Dolly looks gorgeous. She's wearing sort of a light sheer dress, and she's got, you know, her big blonde hair and you know, a lot of jewelry, and her nails look great, and she's got this huge smile on her face. And her arms are wrapped around John Belushi, who's looking much more casual with a sort of a trucker's hat on. He does appear to be wearing a suit coat, like a sport coat, but he may also have jeans. And he's smiling, and his eyes are closed, and he's squeezing her back, and in return is what I mean. And they both look like they are having a ball, and that they are thoroughly enjoying each other's company. And I tried to do a little research on the picture. I guess it was in the late 70s. They had been at a concert or something. Oh, you know, I would imagine a lot of celebrities were at this concert, and then afterwards there may have been some sort of gala or party. But my gosh, these two people who bring so much joy in different ways. And, you know, there's also this sort of kind of a sly, naughty, nice dichotomy to this picture of, well, you know, Dolly Parton can be quite sassy and self-deprecating, and she has a wonderful sense of humor. And but you don't assume that she's the rascal that John Belushi is. You know, she's sort of, you look at her and she just seems sweet and sort of innocent. Even though, again, she can have, you know, she's no stranger to the double entendre. And but Belushi obviously had his demons and, you know, a tragic story. But, and, you know, Dolly's still with us, of course, and John isn't. But my gosh, they just seem to be so happy visiting with each other. And it's wonderful. It's just, this picture really filled my heart. It's really nice. So I'm going to post it on my Instagram. I mean, you could also just probably Google Dolly Parton, John Belushi, but Oh, it's a table you want to sit at. That's for sure. And I have no doubts that John was a gentleman and, you know, probably teased Dolly in a playful way, but with his classic charm. And I'm sure she in this picture, she looks charmed as all get out. So they're having a ball. And my gosh, they were both living the life they wanted to live. John was doing comedy for a living. He had always wanted to. And Dolly was her own. I mean, this was probably around the time where she was breaking out with her solo career, and she wasn't with Porter Wagoner, kind of under his, strict guidance, if you know anything about that. But anyway, a terrific photo, and give it a look, either at that Josh Arnold on Instagram or Google it. It really brought me a lot of joy, and I hope it brings you joy too. I spent the last three podcasts giving you. Four podcasts. Yes, I spent the last four podcasts talking about a brief history of mine. And it was based on one question, a terrific question by a fellow named Dustin. And in spending four podcasts on one question, I haven't gotten to many other questions that have been sent to me. So today I'm going to get to a good stack of them. And most of them, well, if not all, pertain to comedy. A lot of you are interested in stand-up and the morning show, the Bob and Tom Show and everything. And, you know, I got to be honest, when I started this podcast, I assumed everybody had heard everything they want to know about stand-up comedy because there are so many podcasts about it out there that I kind of thought, well, that's certainly well-worn territory. I don't need to talk much about it. It's everything I have to say about comedy's probably been said, and probably been said in a much better way than I can say it. But I really appreciate your interest in my take on being a stand-up and sort of how I got started and everything like that. And so I'll go ahead and get to some of these questions. The first one comes from Mitch, and he would like to know who would you say influenced you to get into stand-up, and who influenced your style? And that's a great question for any comedian, because first off, I love talking to comedians about their favorite comedians, because sometimes it can be very surprising and unexpected. For instance, one of my favorite comedian sort of facts is that Don Rickles and Bob Newhart were best friends, just loved each other. And I have to think that one of the reasons they were really drawn to each other is because of how different their comedic styles were. Don's being brash and aggressive and insulting, you know. And Bob's being very sort of self-inflicted. He was often the victim, and very patient and slow, and but both so incredibly clever and smart and hilarious. And you know that they just really respected what each other did, because I guarantee they went, well, I could never do what he does. And I love what he's doing. I just couldn't do it. I know a lot of my favorite comedians are guys who I could never do what they do. For those of you who listen to the Bob and Tom Show, you're very familiar with Greg Hahn, who's one of my favorite comedians to watch. And I could never do what he does, because the energy is so high. I'm just not that guy. I'm a very laid back on stage. I'm perhaps too laid back. I could probably use, you know, a little more energy. Who's to say? But, so talking to comedians about who influences them can always be, well, can usually be pretty interesting. My main influence, well, when I was a kid, my parents were good enough and maybe irresponsible enough to let me watch Benny Hill whenever there was a Benny Hill special on the USA Network or on PBS. They would, and I just adored it. I couldn't believe how funny it was. Now, back then, I was obviously attracted to all of the slapstick and not really the wordplay that was going on. And I, you know, even at the age of 5 or 6 or whatever, I'm sure there was something about a woman running around in a bra that I found appealing. I probably didn't realize how appealing I would later find it, but I. But anyway, I loved Benny Hill, and I loved a lot of the guys who were in movies at the time. You know, Steve Martin and John Candy and Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray and that class of comic actor. And then stand-up wise, I loved Stephen Wright, and you know, there was a I would watch pretty much anything that my parents were watching, but I liked the guys that I got. You know what I mean? Carlin I didn't get as a kid, so he wasn't a favorite as a kid, and guys like that. But I liked. Oh, boy. I mean, I got to give this guy credit because he has a joke that when I was a kid, I couldn't believe how funny it was. Now, if I were to go see him, I would, you know what? I bet I would really appreciate it. I would really think, I'm talking about Yakov Smirnoff. And I just remember he had a joke when I was a kid. He said, you know, in that thick Russian accent, that sort of gee whiz, you know, fresh to America attitude he had. He said he recently quit smoking cold turkey and now he only smokes ham. And I'm telling you, 8-year-old Josh Arnold thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. He couldn't believe how good that was. Would I laugh at that today? Yes. Are you kidding me? But I would kind of laugh for a different reason. But not laughing. I would still laugh with it. Don't get me wrong. But I think I would laugh at it being at how silly it is as opposed to back then how I couldn't believe how brilliant it was. But my main when I finally decided, you know what, I'm going to give stand up a shot. It was, and I'm not talking about the stand up I did in school because I did a lot, you know, in grade school and junior high and in high school. But I when I really decided, hey, I'm going to go to an open mic. when I decided in my adult life to try to give stand-up a shot, it was all because of one comedian and one special that I watched. And I remember it was late at night, and I turned on HBO, and the special was about to start. And I go, oh, I've heard, I had heard some of this guy's stuff, and I liked it. I'm going to watch this special. And the rest is history. It was Robert Schimmel, and the special is Unprotected, and you can still get it. And I was just blown away. It's so funny and so honest. And what I loved, one of the things I've always loved, I like blue humor, I'll be honest. I like dirty jokes, and I like inappropriate humor. And the thing about Schimmel is, and Tom Griswold actually put it perfectly one day. He said, Robert Schimmel is the cleanest, dirty comic you'll ever see. And what he means, and he's exactly right, is nothing feels gratuitous. Schimmel's, he'll cuss, and he will talk very frankly about sexual things, but it all feels real and honest, and he's not doing it to shock, unless he's doing it to shock. And what I mean by that is sometimes he'll be inappropriate just to get you. You totally know he wants to make you laugh first. So he's not just being shocking for the sake of being. It's all right. It's hard to explain. He knows very well what he's doing. He's not just he's not trying to shock out of laziness or just to get a response. He's he's thumbing his nose at the audience a little bit, going, hey, I'm going to shock you, and wasn't that kind of fun, and let's move on to the real stuff again. Like, you know, so it's really masterful, and the main thing is I laughed and laughed a lot, and I got to see him before he passed away at a small bar called Mississippi Nights in St. Louis, and I got to talk to him a little bit afterwards. And he signed my copy of Unprotected. I ordered the DVD, and it was great. And I, you know, watching that, I went, that's what I want to try. And he certainly influenced my style. He certainly, when I first started, man. And you know what? I bet if I watched, it's been a while since I've watched like video of my most recent stand-up act. I bet I could see. I could probably go, oh, I'm doing Schimmel there, or that's a face that he would have made, or whatever. Like, I bet it's still in there, even though I think I've come into my own. Well, I certainly have much more than I've got my own voice more than I did when I first started. But anyway, he absolutely influenced my stand-up style, and also. Dennis Miller was a big influence, and not so much, you know, he does a lot of political comedy, and I don't, so it wasn't so much like that, but it was more in his attitude of don't talk down to the audience, let the audience come up to you, to your intelligence level, and let them... And, you know, if they don't get a reference, that's fine. They'll get the next one. That kind of thing. I always found that very respectful of Dennis Miller. Some people think it's kind of snotty. I don't. I think it's the opposite. I think it's, hey, I'm giving my audience the benefit of the doubt that they know what I'm talking about and that they can keep up. I think that's great. He also, there's just a technical thing. I don't take the mic out of the mic stand. I just stand up there with a lot of times with my hands in my pockets. And I think I got that from watching Miller. Another Miller who influenced my comedy was Larry Miller. Larry Miller to me is the king of telling a story. And well, for instance, he has a half hour special out there, and in 30 minutes, he does two bits. The first 15 is a bit about drinking, and the second 15 is a bit about skiing. And they're loaded with jokes. There's not a word out of place, but they're cohesive stories. And that's a skill, and that's something that I'm really trying to get better at. Quite honestly, and I should be watching more Larry Miller. He's also, I've mentioned this before, I think, influenced this podcast more than anyone might be comfortable with. If you accused me of cribbing his outline, I would plead guilty. So, good question, Mitch. Thank you. And John wrote in asking, could you discuss your technique for writing comedy? I've been watching Jerry Seinfeld's show, Comedians in Cars, getting coffee, and I realized there's so much more to comedy than just jokes. Yeah, I mean, that's astute of you. There are plenty of people out there that still think, and I hate to ruin this surprise, or I hate to ruin this, but you might be surprised to know that a lot of people think when they go to see a stand-up comedian that that person is going up on stage and just talking about what's in their head, and that they've never said, they think they've never said those things before. And, that's just not the case. You are typically, unless you're at like some sort of open mic night type thing, or in New York where guys are trying out new material, you know, in the middle of a showcase type show, you are seeing very well thought out, well rehearsed, practiced material, and there's an art to that. Don't be disappointed if you go, oh. So let's say, for instance, if you were to go to a comedy club on a Friday night for the 8 p.m. show and then watch the 10:30 show, you might be shocked at how similar both are. I mean, I'm certainly a comedian that I keep the same inflections on certain words, and I really do not change up my delivery at all. Now, I will, I'm pliable to the audience. You know, if the audience is responding a certain way to a certain type of material, I'll change things up, or I'll, if an audience is a bit more relaxed, not, you know, howling with laughter, but kind of, but they're still clearly enjoying themselves, my energy might stay softer. Whereas if I'm in a sold out show and the place is rowdy, my energy will be will match the audience a little bit more. That's just how I perform. A lot of performers do the opposite. They're terrific at they put out an energy that the audience then picks up. I tend to pick up my energy from the audience. So it's just different styles. Writing is a tough thing to talk about because I don't write my jokes in the same way. They sometimes they'll come to me out of the blue. Sometimes I'll actually sit down and go, man, I was thinking about how funny, whatever, this is made up, but fast food drive-thrus are, and what can I say about those? And I'll actually try to write out some jokes about that. My favorite type of writing is writing on stage, and that is just kind of riffing on it. So if I have two or three jokes about, let's say, drive-thrus, I'll just start talking about them, and maybe I won't find a joke. Or maybe I'll find what ends up being the best joke in that bit about drive-thrus. I love writing on stage. It's a lot of fun. And that's an interesting thing about stand-up. It might be the only, thing out there where in order to get better, you have to fail publicly. You have to be bad in front of an audience. If you're a musician, you can practice your guitar and behind a closed door for hours and get better. If you're a comedian, you can't get better unless you're sucking in front of people. It's a weird thing. And it's a painful thing. You have to do bad in front of an audience in order to get better. Now, you don't go up going, I've got to do bad tonight. No, you go up thinking you're going to do good. You think that the jokes that you have are really going to work and that they're funny and that they're clear, they make sense, and that they're universal. And sometimes you find out nobody knew what I was talking about, or if they did, they didn't think it was funny at all. It's a weird thing. I'd be hard-pressed to think of anything else where you have to fail publicly in order to get better. You could maybe argue sports, but even, it's tough to say, but stand-up is absolutely that way. So my writing process is kind of all those things. Sometimes I sit down and write. Sometimes I just think things will just come to me. And then sometimes I'll write while I'm actually on stage. And that's a lot of fun. All of them are fun, but my current favorite. DJ wants to know what I find more challenging, writing jokes to perform alone during stand-up or writing jokes on the fly during the Bob and Tom show. What's more challenging, writing jokes for stand-up, because you have to hone them and you have to perfect them and you have to, I mean, they're always sort of growing and changing, but they have to work, and they don't always work right off the bat. Now, when you're writing jokes, when you're improvising jokes during the Bob and Tom show, which is what I do, they don't always work. But when they don't work, you're on to the next thing in like 30 seconds. So you don't have to focus on that anymore. Or you can spin it. You can go, well, that didn't get anything, or that sucked. Or the other guys will make fun of me for how bad it was, and therefore turning that bad joke into something funny, or at least something entertaining. So it's more challenging to actually work out a bit for stand-up for me than it is to just improvise right off the top of my head, because you're taking risks, but oftentimes the strikeouts or during the morning show, quickly forgotten. Yeah, so that's a very good question, DJ. James writes in. Oh, this is very nice, James. He says, how has your elevated status, thank you very much, as a host on the Bob and Tom Show affected your stand-up performances? First off, bravo, James, for using the word affected, A-F-F-E-C-T-E-D, and not impacted. I hate that. Maybe you know that, but impacted should only be used when you're talking about teeth or meteors. The reason I think impacted is used so often is because people don't know the difference between affect and effect. It's simpler than you think. Effect with an E is a noun, so the special effects were great. Affect is used as, just the way he did. How has it affected? I guess you could say the affect causes the effect, or you can just use impact. So the no, I think that made sense. Anyway. How has your elevated status affected your stand-up performances? I'll tell you this. They have gotten both they've gotten easier in some ways, and they've gotten more difficult in some ways. They've gotten easier in that audiences are now coming a lot more often are coming to see me as opposed to just seeing a comedian. When an audience goes out to a comedy club and they don't know who the comedian is, they need to get to know them a little bit from watching them and listening to them. And if an audience already kind of knows who I am, they're going to probably appreciate more of my jokes because they know where I'm coming from more so than somebody that they just that they're now meeting for the first time. So if I have a particularly silly or maybe even kind of a harsh joke, they know, hey, we know this guy. We can trust him. He's being silly or he's being playfully harsh. You know, it's. But if somebody doesn't know me in the audience and I tell jokes like they go, well, this guy's just wacky, or does he really think that's funny, or, oh, he's mean. No, I mean, and also audiences that know me tend to be so therefore they're more generous. They're going to let me get away with more. Because they ideally already think I'm funny, otherwise they wouldn't be there. And yeah, so they're gonna let me slide a bit more. Now, what's made it more difficult is I get heckled way more than I used to. Because for the same reason, people know me and they know what I respond to on the air, and they know they feel like. That we're friends and they can just shout out and talk to me. So it's still considered heckling, even though most of the time it's not negative. It's usually a reference to the Bob and Tom Show, or it's, you know, they'll just yell out. So, I mean, sometimes it's negative, but it's not. So they'll yell, hey, fat ass, or whatever, which is weird, but. They hear Tom do it, you know. Granted, he usually does it in a more clever way than that, but he, and so they, you know, they're just in on the joke, and they want to be a part of it. But yes, I get heckled a lot more than I used to, and what I do now is I try to embrace it. When you first start off comedy, the heckler is your worst nightmare. Because they're interrupting you. They're not, you know, they can, look, hecklers are difficult, whether they're negative or positive. And there are different types of hecklers. There's the heckler that doesn't like you. The guy that's going to yell out, not funny, or you suck, or whatever. You know, there's, that's one type. The other type are the hecklers who think they're helping you. And you'll get, boy, every comedian gets this, where somebody will shout out and the comedian will respond and it will get a very big laugh. And after the show, that heckler will come up and go, hey, I'm the one that yelled out. I sure made that funny for you, didn't I? No, you didn't. You did not at all. Here's what you did. I was bench pressing and you threw 50 extra pounds onto the bar as I was bench pressing. And guess what? I lifted it up and I kept bench pressing. So all you did was give me more work. You made it harder for me, but because I was able to do it, you think that you helped in some way. You didn't. I had to I had to do the heavy lifting there. So please don't ever have that. Well, it's a fallacy. You didn't help. Yes, it may have been the biggest laugh of the night, but it's because the comedian spun it into a way, into something funny. You interrupted them. Now, like I said, I have grown to embrace. But this is probably a dangerous thing to say. Also, I'm telling you now, don't heckle. But I also say, hey, I've grown to embrace it. That doesn't mean I want you heckling. All right, do your best not to. But when it happens, I try to look at it as an opportunity and not an obstacle anymore. And I'm trying to find Ryan's question. Ryan wrote in asking, do you have a story of just destroying a heckler? And I don't. I mean, I've definitely done it, and I've done it successfully. But here's what happens sometimes. When you're heckled and you go after the heckler, audiences are very, very fickle. They want to see you destroy the heckler, but only to a certain degree. They, if you go too far, and you never know what this line is, you don't know until the audience shuts down on you. So, in other words, you don't know where the line is until you've crossed it, and it's kind of too late. So, at least that's how it is for me. So, when somebody heckles and you go after them, there is a point where you can go after them too much, and the audience then goes, you know what? That's too much. We're not on the comedian's side anymore. And they were never really on the heckler's side, but they will defend their own. And a heckler is part of the audience. And you can get to a point where you've done too much. Now, what I try to do with some hecklers who just want the attention, or they're just trying to have fun, and they do think they're helping or whatever, I just talk to them a little bit, and I try to ask them about themselves and what they're doing out that night or whatever. And I try to find some jokes in there, and that's a lot of fun. That can be, it may not get the rafter shaking laughter or cheers that absolutely annihilating a heckler will get to a point, but I think it's really rewarding. And sometimes you get material that you can use later on in other shows as well. Michael wrote in and wanted to know, well, he asks if I would talk about the infamous show in Toledo. It's often mentioned in on the Bob and Tom Show. Toledo is referenced all the time as sort of my Waterloo. And, you know, Michael asks what exactly happened. Well, I'll tell you, I was fairly new to doing road comedy. Meaning performing stand-up in cities other than where I lived. And I had just done my first Bob and Tom appearance. And it went pretty well. I was in there with Greg Warren, and we were on our way to Toledo when we stopped in Indianapolis to do the Bob and Tom show. Yeah, I may have a little bit of the time. It may have been like the next week we were doing Toledo. Anyway, I had just come off a pretty good first appearance on the Bob and Tom show, and was now going to open for Greg Warren in Toledo. I was going to do 25 minutes after the MC and before him. So we get there, and my gosh, the club is beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful comedy clubs there is, and it's connected to, at the time at least, it was connected to a Bonefish Grill, which is a wonderful restaurant, and the comedians could eat for free. It's like, oh my gosh. And the hotel was gorgeous and super nice. And it was directly across from, and I think it still is directly across from the club. So all you had to do was walk out of your room and cross the street and walk up to the comedy club, and you were there. There was no driving. It was just a perfect setup. It's like, this is great. It had a wonderful staff and a terrific manager and a terrific green room and Oh man, and the Greg Warren is a club draw, and so these shows were sold out. Like, this is going to be an awesome weekend. Just a lot of fun and very comfortable. And the MC is a guy who I really liked. His name was Chili Chalice. He unfortunately has passed away, but he was a super charming, likable comedy veteran. And he was emceeing the week, and he was from the area. So he went up and would do 15 minutes of just killer local material that the audiences just ate up. I mean, he murdered. And so I was excited. Like, oh, my gosh, this crowd is so hot. This was a Thursday night, the first shows. And so I go up. Now, I thought I had a couple silly jokes up front. Because I thought it would be a good idea to show the audience, hey, this is a silly, fun-loving guy. We can have fun with this dude. He's not taking himself too seriously. He just wants to be, well, forgetting that the audience, kind of getting back to the audience, has no idea who I am, so they have to know if they can trust me or not. They didn't know if they could trust me. So one of my first jokes was like, earlier today, I was at Hardee's, and I asked the girl, are you working hard or Hardee's working? And now that's a very silly joke that you might laugh at because you know who I am. And Josh, you're just being stupid. Why would you ever, Well, the audience thought I was trying to sell that as like, isn't that a great joke? When my point was kind of like, no, that's a bad joke, but you're a silly guy, and oh, we can learn to appreciate. So my opening wasn't strong. Well, I get past those, so I'm already in kind of a hole, and I get to what is my better material, and that's just, getting nothing at all. And I go on to bomb for 25 minutes. I just bomb, which is, no one's laughing. People are sitting there awkwardly. Now, I've been told, and I did see this, but that the Toledo Funny Bone can be tough for middles, which is what I was the feature act or a middle. Because the food is coming out typically during the feature set. So as I'm doing my jokes, servers are bringing burgers and steaks and stuff to tables. And so there's a little bit of chatter with that. And then they're busy eating. They want to eat their food hot. And so they're taking bites. They're not really laughing out loud. They're eating. So they're going to be a little quieter during a feature set. Well, that doesn't mean that there should be no laughter because... that's certainly what I got, though. Just no laughter at all. And I remember thinking, oh, man, I hope things go better for Greg. And of course they did. He went up and he killed. They loved him. So they just didn't care for me on Thursday night. It's like, bummed out or whatever. So the next day, Greg and I were at lunch or getting coffee or whatever. And he is helping me with my set. He goes, hey, maybe we should move this joke here and that joke there. And tonight, why don't you go ahead and just do 20 minutes? And for both shows, I'll tell the manager to save face for you a little bit. I'll tell the manager I want to work on some new stuff and I need a little more time. So can we cut Josh down? And by the way, this club is booked by arguably the top booker, at least in the Midwest, if not all over the country. A comedy booker that books like 14 clubs, or at the time it was that. And if you did well, you got to get on his list of guys that he would book for 14 clubs. And I was not yet on this guy's list. Greg brought me there with this dude's permission. And he was nice enough to let me go. So there's that added pressure to this weekend as well. So anyway, I'm down to 20 minutes and I've changed my setup a little bit. And that first show Friday night, I bomb just as hard. I mean, they love Chili. He kills. I go up, crickets, and Greg goes up and kills. These guys are annihilating, and I cannot do anything right. I'm just not doing well. And that happens again the second show Friday. And Saturday rolls around, and Greg goes, why don't we bring you down to 15 minutes? And, just do 15. You've got a decent 15 here. Some of that extra 10 that you were doing, some of it is a hit and miss and is a little fatty. Just do this 15. And Saturday first show, sold out crowd, hundreds of people. I just continue to eat it. It's just awful. I'm bombing so hard, and I get what I still consider the worst heckle I've ever gotten. And and it wasn't necessarily even directed at me. It was just a natural response for this gentleman to make. I tell a joke, and I'm if I'm doing 15 minutes, this was like at minute 10. So I'm right in the kind of smack dab, I'm in the heart of my act, and I tell a joke that normally does well. By the way, most of this material did well elsewhere. And in fact, it did well on the Bob and Tom Show where my comedy heroes enjoyed it. So I thought, oh my gosh, I just don't know what's happening here. So I tell a joke to silence. Every joke was getting silence. And the room is completely silent. And after like 2 seconds, I just hear this guy in the middle of the audience go, "Wow." And it was the worst heckle I've still got, because this person, the wow meant so much. It meant he couldn't believe how unfunny I was. He probably couldn't believe that I was still up there, that I hadn't run off crying or just given up or anything. And it was such a loaded wow that it crushed me. And the Saturday Second Show was no better. I just really, really bombed. And so that was 5 shows in a row. And I walked off stage. I didn't even stay to watch Greg. I walked right off stage after my set and across the street, and I went to bed in my hotel. And I just sat there going, what have I done? I've recently quit my full-time job, and I have no business doing this. I don't know what's happening. And Greg called me, and I didn't, after his set, and I didn't even answer. I just so Sunday, you know, we met up, and he's like, "Are you all right? This is, you know," he was being nice, but he was also being, kind of a harsh coach. He was saying, "Hey, look, some of that stuff isn't working for a reason. It's not necessarily the audience. It's not as funny as it could be, and all this stuff." So it was a tough, tough week, and finally, we had a Sunday show. And Greg goes, "Tonight I want you to do 10 minutes. So he cut me down again, and I was doing 10 minutes. And I went up, and it was a good show. I got laughs. And it wasn't great, but it was good. And I made some changes that Greg and I had worked on together, and they worked. And I thought, okay, this isn't going to be easy. This is not an easy job. This is a tough job. And, you know, I realized with you know, Greg and I had talked about it, it should be tough, shouldn't it? I mean, anything, they say anything worth doing, I don't know, there's some saying about how things should be tough. And so, or anything difficult is worth doing, or whatever it is. Do you know what I'm talking about? What is the saying? Do you remember? Jason doesn't remember either. Maybe I'm making it all up. I guess what I'm saying is it should be difficult. And I should earn the right to do it by putting in the work. And I learned a lot, that it was a tough, brutal weekend, and I've never been back. It just hasn't worked out that way. I ended up getting from later gigs, getting on the list of that booker and working all of his clubs and doing pretty well. And that guy really, really helped me out a lot. And I'll always be appreciative of that. And I did get better as well. And I look forward to going back to Toledo. Now, if I go back to Toledo and bomb again, that's gonna cause some issues, but I do look forward to going back and hopefully giving the audience a better time. That's one of the things. I mean, yes, it hurt me because I wasn't being accepted by the audience. They didn't care at all for what I was saying. But it bothered me that I didn't show them a good time. That's always my goal in doing comedy. I want the audience to have a good time. It's not an adversarial position. It's not me versus them. it's we're all in this together, and I want to show them a good time, and I was just disappointed that I couldn't, and I was hurt that they, you know, again, my feelings were hurt, my pride was hurt, but I always want to show the audience a good time. And real quick, I'm just going through the stack here, making sure I didn't miss anything I kind of wanted to talk about this week. Writing jokes, that's good. Yeah, boy, this has got to be exciting. Huh? Me thumbing through my notes. You know what? Here's a quick question I can answer for those of you who listen to the Bob and Tom Show. Dave wants to know if we have any plans to finish the 69 song. Now, I'm going to give you a little peek behind the curtain here. A lot of you might not know what the 69 song is, because it's something that often happens during what's called the local break. We broadcast, is this all fine to talk about? We broadcast out of Indianapolis, and we come back on the air in Indianapolis only for a minute, 30 seconds, 15 seconds, whatever, and then we go to the national part of things. So sometimes when you hear us coming back from commercial, we're already laughing, or somebody might be saying something, you go, what are they talking about? It's because we were laughing about something that happened in that Indianapolis section, or that was being discussed then. So oftentimes you're not missing anything. But anytime that the weather in Indianapolis is 69 degrees, Chick and I would very douchily hoot and holler and make noise. And I would start singing the 69 song, which typically goes something like, what we do, babe, is you lay down and I lay down. And the joke is Tom always stops. He goes, all right, that's enough, you child, you moron, that kind of thing. Well, Dave wants to know if we're actually going to finish the 69 song. And the answer is no, because, you know, he says it appears to irritate Tom. I think it would be great to finish it and really bug him. Well, it bugs him enough. And the joke to me is that we never get to finish the song. And why should we? It's ridiculous. So I appreciate you wanting to hear a full-length finished version there, Dave. But it's not good. The fun for me is getting cut off. I like that. John asks, how are you and your comedian friends handling not being able to do stand-up during this COVID scare? It's tough. Not so much for me. I've got the morning show, and my gosh, I thank God every day that I do. It scratches the creative itch, and it keeps my lights on, and man, I'm just so thankful to be working. A lot of my comedian friends are doing their best. They are doing Zoom shows, or they're, you know, working for 25% capacity audiences, and you know, they're doing what they can. So for the most part, they're doing okay. Some of them are working other jobs during this, and it's only going to make their comedy better, because when you have a job while you're being a comedian, you can relate more to an audience and talk about different things. So it's a very tough situation, but it's going to get better. And I think there'll be some really good comedy that comes out of it. Philip has asked about the connection between comedy and horror. He mentions that Gilbert Gottfried is a big fan of horror, and other comedians are as well. Nick Griffin, Brian Posehn, and, you know, he says, what's this about? Essentially, I'm paraphrasing Philip's question, but it's a really good question that I could spend 45 minutes talking about, but I don't think it would be particularly interesting to too many people, because it's sort of niche. But I can tell you this, a lot of good comedy and a lot of good horror come from overcoming adversity. They say the best comedy comes from pain, and in many ways that's true. I know I got one of the reasons I probably got funny was as a defense mechanism to be accepted, to deflect you know, potential bullying or insults. That's a very common story with comedians. Others have had to, you know, A lot of comedians you hear about talking about growing up poor or growing up in broken homes or that kind of thing. So comedy does come from pain as a defense mechanism, and horror deals with similar adverse situations. Horror and comedy are also elicit involuntary responses. Things scare you, and you know, you just feel scared. You can't necessarily control it. It's the same thing with laughter. You find something funny and you laugh. You don't decide I'm going to laugh right now. Something just makes you laugh. So there's probably some sort of physiological connection there as well. But I think a lot of it just has to do with both attract misfits. I guarantee if you were to talk to Gilbert Gottfried as a kid when he was watching those Universal monster movies, he loved the monsters. He could relate probably in a way to Frankenstein's creation or, you know, anybody who's different. Horror fans can sort of appreciate and kind of root for, even though they're the bad guy. The same with comedy. It, you know, a lot of misfits take part in comedy, and it's you can find a community of well, you know, I don't want it to sound bleak, but of the damaged or you know, maybe a little bit of nihilism as well. So. And also people who like entertaining. They like eliciting responses from folks. There's definitely a connection there. These have all been very, very good questions, and I thank you for sending them in. And feel free to send in other questions. Josh, what is it? That Josh Arnold podcast. Is it Josh Podcast? It's joshpodcast@bobandtom.com. I don't even know my own email. Yeah, at bobandtom.com. I apologize for the hemming and hawing. This hasn't been the smoothest one, has it? But I appreciate you sticking with me. Finally, last question is podcast related. Boy, oh boy. I had these... Jason was in here. He watched me stack these up in an order that I could easily access, and I have messed it all up. Luke wants to know, he says, every podcaster I love has a great sign-off. What do you think yours will be? I don't know. I don't have a sign-off, do I? They just sort of end, and sometimes they end Sopranos style, where it's just over. But I one will come. One will come. I want this thing to sort of be organic and just things will come as they do, and we'll figure out what a great sign off will be. In the meantime, I do of course have something to work on for this week. Yes, bettering ourselves is a celebration. Hence this happy music. What a party, man! Oh man! Thank you again for listening. There was. If we were going to edit a podcast, it would be this one. but anyway, things to work on. Well, this was sent in as a suggestion, and I really like it. I do not remember the name of the person who sent it in, so my bad. But I appreciate it nonetheless. This week, if and when you are out shopping, return the shopping cart to the corral, won't you? What are you doing? Why? The people who leave them between cars or haphazardly just outside of the store there, come on. It only takes a few more steps to take that cart and tuck it into the corral. And I find it satisfying. You know what I like to do? And I like to sort of see if I can push the cart not only into the corral but into the back of the cart that's there and see if it fits together. You know what I mean? See if it slides right in. And guess what? If it doesn't, and it kind of bounces halfway out of the corral, whatever, I fix it. All right, I'm not a savage. I don't just leave it there. I know some of you have kids and you're shopping with them, and it's you know, you're trying to get them in the car and everything, and maybe you dropped the milk, and then your phone fell out of your pocket, and you go, you know what, enough of it. The corral or the cart can stay where it is. All right, but look, this week, just try to put it back. Try to put it into the corral, all right? The grocery store workers are they're working hard. Some might argue they're putting their lives in danger these days. Make it easy on them, okay? I think you'll feel better when you put the shopping cart into the into the corral. And since we're still working on a sign-off, you know, I got to come up with something. But since we don't have one now, see ya.
Hey, I'm Chris Van Vliet, host of the number one podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. On the show, I sit down with the biggest names in pro wrestling, sports, film, and beyond. These are real, long-form conversations that go behind the scenes and beyond the headlines with people like John Cena, The Undertaker, Cody Rhodes, and more. We talk mindset, motivation, and what it takes to succeed. This is Insight with Chris Van Vliet. Follow and listen on your favorite platform.